And then to say what we're going to do is turn your water off because you can't pay for it?
We're gonna
not going to tolerate this mess.
We're going to have to leave it.
We're
going to have to leave it there, but we will certainly continue to cover this crucial issue. Maureen Taylor, state chair of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, Mira Karanananthan, is international water campaigner for the Blue Planet Project. That does it for our show. Our website is democracynow.org. We have job openings. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Back in a minute.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll talk about Iraq, the war criminals that took us there in the past and would take us there again.
Every Tuesday night from 10 p.m. to midnight, KBOO brings you the Anjali and the Kid Show with DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. Post national bass, folk, and urban sounds that'll knock you upside the head.
It's Anjali and the Kid every Tuesday night on KBOO.
Tune in Saturday, June 28th for a live broadcast from Good in the Hood. KBOO will broadcast the entertainment from Lilith Albina Park from 2 to 7 p.m. Tune in to hear what's good in the hood Saturday, June 28th from 2 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from stateconstitutions.us, committed to empowering people of every state by providing the complete text and audio of their state constitutions. Those seeking to hold state governments accountable can learn more at stateconstitutions.us.
Well, the Imperial March?
Oh, you know what that means.
Oh, no, not the Imperial March.
We haven't had occasion to play the Imperial March in some time.
No, really. Hey, I want to tell people, first of all, you're listening to KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
That's right.
That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. The number to call, 231-8187. What do we got on tap, Abe?
Well, the longtime listeners of the show know what the Imperial March means.
What does the Imperial March mean?
It means everyone's favorite undead cyborg, Dick Cheney, is in the news.
Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney. The man of the many, many, many mechanical organs.
Yes, he who survives by drinking the blood of young orphans.
He who shoots his friends.
He who is responsible for the greatest foreign policy disaster, arguably, in American history.
Yeah, I think I'd put it right in there.
Yeah, I would.
I mean, you know, you put aside things like slavery and you get...
Yeah, oh, that was it wasn't a foreign policy.
No. It was a natural outcome of a highly racist imperial society. But anyway.
Yeah, not to mention the natural fallout of human beings owning other human beings.
And cotton.
Yeah, right. Dick Cheney.
I
think we can accurately sum up the Bush era as being guided by Cheney's will to power.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think.
And three packs of cigarettes a day and for years.
Three packs of cigarettes a day. Yeah. He was the architect of that era. He was really the prime mover. The president, the shadow president.
The Halliburton man.
The Halliburton man.
Okay, so why are we talking about him?
We're talking about him because he and his daughter, Liz, put an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last week.
I saw that.
We need a little background here.
Yeah.
Right now, Iraq is going to hell.
Well, yeah, it's been going to hell since we knocked Saddam off, though.
Yeah, well, arguably it's been going to hell a lot longer than that. But yeah, things really went bad starting with the American invasion and occupation in 2003.
Yes.
Cheney's invasion.
Well, he said that we would be greeted like
as
heroes.
Liberators.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And that we needed to do this. We needed to invade Iraq.
Right.
Because of the weapons of mass destruction.
And the oil.
And the oil. Right. Yeah. But we didn't talk about that.
No.
It was insulting even to suggest at the time. You remember all this, listeners? I want you to cast your minds back. I want you to cast your minds back to 2002, 2003.
Nobody goes back in their mind beyond yesterday.
Well, maybe.
It's like a cat or a chicken.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, sorry. My cynicism is getting bad.
Well, this is a perfect time for cynicism because this is one of the more cynical chapters in our history.
Yes.
We had been attacked on September 11th, 2001.
And many people who call us often believe it was a put-up job.
Yeah, we're not going to go there today.
We're not going there. Please don't call us about that.
After the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, it was a great opportunity knocking for the neoconservatives who are currently running the country at the time.
And still, I think, are. Personally.
And still probably running the country now. They immediately moved to invade Afghanistan. From whence the attack was orchestrated.
Well, actually, it wasn't orchestrated there. I mean, that was what we were told.
That's what we were told.
Right.
Then immediately the administration began moving to shift the great anger and hatred that had arisen in the American populace, that was bubbling over, the great drive for revenge that much of the country was experiencing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
To gather that up and refocus it on a country that had absolutely nothing to do with the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001.
Yeah.
That country was Iraq. That country has one of the largest reserves of petroleum in the world, reserves that we had coveted for a long time, reserves that many among us believed to be behind the previous invasion of Iraq in 1991 under President Bush's father.
Yeah, and I want to add, you know, there was a war between Iraq and Iran that went on in this period of time.
There was a war between Iraq and Iran.
And it was encouraged a lot by the United States.
It was a lot by the United States.
In very physical, very real ways.
All right. But we all know the history. We all know what happened. We did, in fact, invade Iraq. There were, in fact, no weapons of mass destruction.
Twice. We raided it twice. First time just for the hell of it.
Yes. We toppled a regime which, however oppressive, was a stable one, and replaced it with chaos and with civil war, with sectarian violence, with reprisals for long simmering blood feuds, and on and on and on and on. It turned a not so nice place into a really, really, really nasty place.
Well, yeah. In fact, as a fascist republic, prior to our invasions, it was terrorizing its people. It was a vicious government. It engaged in a horrendous war against Iran.
Yes,
there are a lot of reasons to dislike, and I want to be clear about this: to dislike the Saddam Hussein regime.
Indeed, but only one reason to invade.
Right.
The oil.
Yes.
Right. So. We'll jump forward to today. President Obama inherited an occupied state in Iraq. He pledged to end the war there, to scale back our military engagement there. He managed to not quite do either one, but significantly reduced our military footprint there and the amount of violence experienced both by Iraqi civilians and American military personnel declined significantly.
Right.
So he didn't really end the war or the occupation, but sort of pulled his foot off the gas, if you'll pardon the petro metaphor right there.
I don't know if I will, but go ahead.
Okay. So now much of Iraq has descended into chaos yet again, this time at the hands of an insurgent group, a group of rebels, I guess you could more accurately classify them. They're being painted in certain parts of the media, including the op-ed by Dick Cheney and Liz, as a terrorist group. But they're really not. They're not conducting terrorist operations. They're conducting straight-up military operations.
Well, they be fair. They're crucifying people.
Well, okay,
they're,
all right, fine.
They're doing bad things.
Yes, they are using fear and intimidation and brutality, and they are publicizing those acts to make people afraid of them.
Yeah.
They're a very nasty bunch. They are called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, abbreviated as ISIS.
Or the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant.
Right. But that doesn't make the nice acronym, ISIS.
No, ISIS is right. Better.
Okay, so things are getting pretty bad in Iraq. So Dick Cheney, looking back at all his handiwork going to hell, ISIS has managed, in addition to securing a number of border crossings between Iraq and Syria and a number of major cities in the eastern part of the country, has managed to secure a couple of the country's largest petroleum processing centers,
mm-hmm.
oil refineries.
Mm-hmm.
So Dick Cheney is sitting back and looking at all his handiwork going up in smoke, and has directed his anger towards President Obama. So he and his daughter got together and put up this op-ed, and I want to read you a few passages from this. Now, before we get started, I think those of you who listen to this show for any extended period of time know that neither Joe or myself are particularly huge fans of President Obama's. Was that accurate, would you say, Joe?
I would say that he disappointed me from the beginning.
Yeah, indeed. We're not huge fans of President Obama's.
Yes.
However, in comparison to the previous administration,
I had hopes.
It's still a marked improvement. And I don't want to debate the fine points of that. That is not the point of today's show. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
You think you can make rules, huh?
I can. Okay. I can, because I'm on this side of the microphone.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So the point of today's show is to examine this op-ed from Dick Cheney, point out why it's so incredibly wrong, look at the current situation in Iraq, and then recall exactly how we got ourselves into this mess, and hopefully extract some sort of lesson.
And I have something else that I want to have hopefully happen. I don't think we have time for it, but it's really important. Why, in God's name, is the American press giving any credibility to Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney? And all these guys who messed up and brought us into this
who's
war.
Been wrong about everything forever.
Paul
they
Wolfowitz.
Have never been right about anything ever. And we're going to talk about that,
and
too.
The idiot president?
Right. Which idiot president?
Oh, no. Bush the lesser.
A Bush the dumber. Okay.
Pardon me.
Rarely has a U.S. president been so wrong about so much at the expense of so many, reads the op-ed by Dick and Liz Cheney. Rarely has a U.S. president been so wrong about so much at the expense of so many. I don't think you even have to think very hard to discredit that statement. Look only to his predecessor. Okay. On a trip to the Middle East this spring, we heard a constant refrain in capitals from the Persian Gulf to Israel. Can you please explain what your president is doing? Why is he walking away? Why is he so blithely sacrificing the hard-fought gains you secured in Iraq? Why is he abandoning your friends? Why is he doing deals with your enemies?
No, that's all bad. That's bad stuff.
Yeah, and I also want people to consider something here for a moment. Let's think about this. Let's transpose ourselves back in time once again to the Bush regime. Can you imagine an ex-vice president, let's say Al Gore, just by way of example, publishing a screed like this in a major American newspaper about the military actions of a sitting president? Do you think that would have been tolerated for one instant by the political media establishment of this country? No. For some reason, conservatives have free rein to trash whomever they happen not to like, and that's usually anybody who's not a conservative in the White House. There is a massive double standard at work here, and I think this op-ed is a fine example of that.
But it's in the Wall Street Journal. Everybody knows the Wall Street Journal is the voice of capital.
Well, it absolutely is. But we didn't see anything like this appear in the New York Times, for example. We heard criticisms of the war. We didn't hear it from, news reporters at the Times, of course. But we heard it in their commentary pages. But nothing as full of vitriol as this. Nothing so critical of a sitting commander-in-chief. And I'm not saying that President Obama is necessarily owed deference because he's the commander-in-chief. But there seems to be a line of protocol that conservatives feel free to cross whenever they like. The liberals are not afforded the same sort of latitude.
Well, there's a definite pattern of delegitimization of authority in the Republicans.
Indeed. Indeed. Quoting again from the op-ed, this president is willfully blind to the impact of his policies. This irony. Can you smell the irony? Willfully blind to the impact of his policies, despite the threat to America unfolding across the Middle East, aided by his abandonment of Iraq, he has announced he intends to follow the same policy in Afghanistan. President Obama seems determined to leave office, ensuring he has taken America down a notch. Indeed, the speed of the terrorist takeover of territory in Iraq has been matched only by the speed of American decline on his watch. Those are very strong words.
You think?
Yeah, those are very strong words. And as I mentioned, the irony is thick. To compare the situation that's going on right now and to lay that at the feet of this president is to willfully ignore recent history.
Well, yeah. I mean, I assume our audience is more aware than many. They know that we were falsely brought into this war. They know there were no weapons of mass destruction. They know vicious manipulations were done to discredit those who opposed the war. They know that, in fact, when we got there, it was a disaster from the get-go. They know that it rearmed everybody. And now they know that the Ba'athists, the original fascist political party that Saddam Hussein represented, are back, as well as these Islamic fundamentalists, and that no problem has been resolved, and that, in fact, the country, which was largely Shia, is now facing an army which is largely fundamentalist Sunni.
Yeah, indeed. As you mentioned, the regime of Saddam Hussein was part of a Sunni minority that ruled by mm-hmm. force and intimidation for mm-hmm. a long time. But the government of the Hussein regime was largely secular.
Yeah.
Those sectarian divisions were either muffled or muzzled or pushed aside under his regime. The fact was that there you didn't see these large-scale clashes between different sects of Islam happening. But obviously, now we do. And I should mention that 503-231-8187 is the number to call here at this radio program.
Yeah. I think it's important to understand, and this goes beyond all the conspiracy theories, et cetera, there has been a long-standing plan, apparently, by the right wing, which dominates American politics in so many ways, to gain control of all the oil assets in the Middle East region. We have played nice with the Saudis, who are bad guys in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. We have essentially played nice for a long time with Saddam, and then when we decided to dump him, we were playing nice with whoever else it is. But basically, it's the oil companies.
Yeah, basically it is.
And this is all about oil.
It is all about
oil.
It
had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction.
No.
And it had nothing really to do about democracy. I don't think we ever were really concerned with that issue.
No, not at all. It takes only a moment's reflection to realize that the arguments behind the invasion of Iraq were empty. There was nothing there.
And it was Dick Cheney's argument.
If you take only two points, let's say the two most prominent points in that argument, one, that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, and two, that his was an inherently undemocratic regime that deserved to be overthrown simply because it was an undemocratic regime, then one has to wonder, why not all of the other undemocratic regimes around
like
the
Saudi
world?
Arabia?
Like Saudi Arabia, like North Korea, that possessed weapons of mass destruction. Why not overthrow those countries?
Well,
we could draw up a nice long list.
No, but wait,
right?
North Korea has a cute little king.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to get rid of a little king.
Right. And the answer is, well, none of those places had one of the world's largest reserves of petroleum. The invasion of Iraq was a prerogative of profit. We all know it. It's blindingly clear now, even if it was obfuscated by the powers that be at the time.
So, all right. I understand all this. I understand the rise of Cheney the insane.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't understand is why the media, why the establishment media particularly, is giving enormous credibility to these failed idiots, to the Wolfowitzes, to the Cheneys, you know, to all these people who were full of it.
Well, because they're the real Americans. They're the real patriots. They always have country on their minds. They're always, you know, operating with God at their backs and wind in their sails.
Well, and it's all very weird to me. I mean, historically, for example, Afghanistan, the British tried, the Greeks tried to control Afghanistan, the Macedonians, much later in history, the British tried to control Afghanistan, failed. The Russians, Soviets, tried to control Afghanistan, failed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't understand the hubris that asserts that we can somehow make this work for us.
Well, because we can't.
Well, no.
We simply can't. I want to quote a little more from this this op-ed here.
You're just mad at Cheney, aren't you?
I am mad at Cheney. I think he's one of the great criminals of our time. In fact, he and the rest of his regime should be brought to The Hague and put up on war crimes and imprisoned.
That's not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen. Of course it's not going to happen. Why? Because of American exceptionalism, because of this pervasive belief that we somehow represent the end of history and that we can't ever act in a malicious or a profit-driven or a cynical way because we are the United States of America. We are the very soul and expression of democracy, and everything we do is divinely touched and for the greater good. Well, it's a bunch of hogwash. We allowed ourselves to be hijacked by a bunch of thugs. They invaded a country that never threatened us, that had nothing to do with the attack on our soil, and they did it to enrich themselves and their buddies. And we have yet to extricate ourselves from the moral abyss that is the war and occupation of Iraq. That's why I hate Dick Cheney.
Gee, you're really kind of excised about this.
I am.
See, I have a different view. I just say this is the normal.
I can see where you're coming from, but I think it represented normal turned up several notches. We really went off the deep end in the Bush administration.
Well, late stage capitalism is like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. All right, here's from the op-ed again.
Okay.
Iraq is at risk of falling to a radical Islamic terror group, and Mr. Obama is talking about climate change.
I like that juxtaposition, though. See, one is kind of effeminate and la-di-da, climate change. The other is masculine and full of spears, arrows.
Well,
and,
there you have it. You know. Barbarians at the gate. That's a whole lot more sexy than rising sea levels,
well,
right?
I don't know about sexy. Sexy is not the right word. It's more masculine. Dick Cheney, very masculine.
Yes, okay. Very masculine.
Yeah.
Terrorists can take control of more territory and resources than ever before in history, and the president goes golfing. Now, as I mentioned, the irony is simply bubbling over, and that clip is one of the more ironic.
Well, like,
and in a little while, we'll play a clip from the Bush years, and you'll understand why.
Well, okay. All right. I yield the floor to you totally on this, because you're more outraged than I am. I just think these are the same scallywags and imposters and ugly fascists that have always been the dominant figures in not just the Republican Party, but in general in American politics since World War II.
Well, you're right that a major narrative in American history has been a struggle between the capitalist ruling class and the rest of us.
Well, I don't think it's a struggle, unfortunately.
Well, it is. I feel as if it's been a struggle for my adult life. I've been pushing back against these
people. Well,
you know,
I felt bad when they discontinued the Oldsmobile. But other than that, I'm cool.
Yeah, that was a blow.
Yeah, The Pontiac, too.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
Something against Native Americans.
Let's take a couple phone calls. And then, actually, hey, Steve, let's play that clip. That other clip.
First the clip.
All right, let me read again this line. Oh, okay. Well, we'll see if we can't pull that up later.
Okay.
Let's go to the phones. Michael, good morning. Oh, we lost Michael. Sue, good morning.
Hi, Sue.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that remember when in that clip where Cheney said, or in the article where Cheney said that he was talking to people all over in Iraq or something like that.
Yes,
we have to
all over the Middle
remind
East.
Ourselves
yeah.
that we have to remind ourselves that the people that he talks to are like oil executives. He
yes,
to the common
yeah,
man.
Exactly.
Well, and he doesn't speak Arabic, so it's really irrelevant.
Yeah, it's not like he's
exactly
down at a cafe someplace just talking to people.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You're sure. Absolutely right.
Yeah, I can see that. All right, bye.
Bye bye. All right, who else do we have, Steve? James,
good morning.
Oh, hi, James.
The best I can tell is that imperialists control the entire media in this nation, and their goal is to keep us on this left-right debate, this, what I call fascism versus fascism debate. It's not their goal to make sure that the people are in charge. It's just to keep us distracted.
Keep us distracted from what?
From focusing on what it would take to place the people back in charge.
In other words, it's to keep
the 99% from being united.
But I have a real question for you, James. You know, you have an alternate view of history that we tolerate, but I really don't understand one thing. When were the people in charge?
The people under the federal system were sovereign. In other words,
I got all the theory. When were the people in charge? Give me a time, an example, something in real history, not in theory.
Well, I would say that from 1800, from the second American Revolution in 1800, when Jefferson came to power, mm-hmm. up until Lincoln came to power.
Oh, so the period of time of the growth of slavery and the beginnings of the growth of the industrial state and the beginning of the development of imperialism, including the Mexican War, etc. That was a period in which the American people actually had a democracy.
The imperialists have had their foothold here on the North American continent prior to the revolution.
Oh yeah, no argument that.
And they have been able to buy our government, buy various parts of the federal government, the state government, the local government. So yes, the people were in charge, but what happened is when we turned the entire control, when we went from a decentralized economic system to a centralized economic system, that completely marginalized the people.
Okay.
And that
I'm going to have to stop you right here because here's my problem, James, and it's really a serious problem. I've spent many years teaching American history. I followed much of the period of time that you speak of as if it were a democracy. And there ain't no such animal. It just really isn't the case. The struggles that went on, in many cases, had elements of democracy, but it was never, 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 ever a democracy in the sense that you're arguing that it was. And you're welcome to call and you're welcome to argue, but I think we need to move on this topic. So I'm going to let you go.
All right.
Anyway, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, he was actually talking a little sense there. I think the shift to industrial capitalism did marginalize a great number of working people. But anyway, it's hard to say where James is coming from at any one time.
Well, no, I think I don't want to spend time on him. Never mind.
Okay, so we've got that clip I was talking about before.
Yeah, let's hear the clip.
Here it is. Here's the line from the Cheney op-ed that brought this to mind. Terrorists take control of more territory and resources than ever before in history, and the president goes golfing. Now,
we must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Wait a minute. Is that the president of the United States golfing?
Yeah. We need to do everything we can to stop the terrorist killers. Now watch this drive. Your president,
Not mine, ladies and gentlemen. Not mine.
Yeah.
The one who got in phonally by a Supreme Court
that's another story entirely.
Oh, yeah.
The point I'm after today is...
Go for it.
That this was... The Bush regime represented a dramatic derailment of any possible positive tendencies that were being expressed in American politics and in American government. It seems to me that before the invasion of Iraq, before mm-hmm. the September 11th attacks, there was a possibility, however slim, that we might be able to steer ourselves more or less in an enlightened sort of direction. But since that time, everything has gone wrong badly, badly wrong. We now live in a modern surveillance state. The bottom fell out of the global economy. There is a parasitic transnational ruling class that is stronger than it has ever been before. We have wasted several trillion dollars on a war of choice in the Middle East that was paid for entirely with borrowed money. And the future now, not only for this country, but for the rest of the world, because of the climate change that Cheney so blithely dismisses, is a grim one. And it was during the Bush regime when things really went wrong.
Well, I understand your argument.
Okay.
And indeed, things got worse.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is the pattern of American political life,
mm-hmm.
the accretion of power and wealth by a very small number of people.
Yes.
The development of a mechanical, technological, industrial system. And post-industrial system, which is what we have right now.
No, we don't. I don't understand that term, post-industrial.
Well, it means that we don't make most of the stuff. We hire it outside.
Yeah, but the stuff is still made.
The stuff is still made.
We still live in the industrial paradigm. Yes.
Okay, all right. All right. All of that is, to me, a straight line of the development of, a logical line of the development of the American capitalist model. I don't see beyond certain social reforms that did happen and are now arbitrarily and absolutely being smashed, not just by the Republican reactionaries, but by the Obama administration. I don't see any real sign of an America that had a possibility of being anything but what it is turning into. I believe that the illogical war in Iraq will go on. That it is one of those endless wars. I assume that the 500 or the 300 or whatever the hell it is, advisors, will turn into 1,000, that the 1,000 will get hurt, and then it'll turn into 5,000, and we will be back there doing the same damn thing.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I also need to pose this question to you. Do you believe that the true winner of the 2000 presidential election, Al Gore, had he taken office, do you think we would have invaded Iraq?
I don't think so, but that's alternative history, and it doesn't happen. It doesn't matter. It isn't a thing.
Yeah, I understand that, but it helps to frame the scope of the debate we're having today.
Well,
I'm saying you're
saying that certain individuals, had they gotten power, would have done better than the individuals who have
yes,
power now.
Yes, that is exactly what
but
I'm saying.
But they didn't get
yes,
power.
Yes, I know that, Joe.
Yeah, but...
Let's go to the phones. Thomas, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Real quick, on the previous call, you guys were a little hard on him. I think, maybe if he had more chance to articulate his point, I think what he might have been trying to say was, something along the lines of degree is significant. Of course, we never had a perfect democracy, and these oligarchic powers have always had been most powerful positions. But
yeah, that's true.
There were times when we had relatively more and relatively less accountability of the government and some mechanisms of at least partial democratic control, such as in the, post-war era, you might say.
Yeah.
So I think there's still some validity to what he's saying. As far as framing the discussion about the responsibility for the war in Iraq, I would say to you this, going back to the, 2001, that authorization to use military force
mm-hmm.
that was voted on?
Yeah.
It seems like that had broad bipartisan support, didn't it?
It did, yes.
Yeah, and it did, and it seems like Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton were right in there with everyone
they
else.
They were,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to note, too, that the, you go to any of the bodies in the United States that are recognized as promoting civil liberties and constitutional law, and you talk about things like the Patriot Act, and, what has the party done in power? The political party that's has a presidency to do anything to roll that back. Obviously, you want to talk about Dick Cheney and these secret memos and these different Rube Goldberg constructs to try to justify flagrant violations of international law. Well, now we have the transparency president in there who's made a new record of having these signing statements. You can talk about Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush sort of opening the door to this massive criminal enterprise in violation of international law, and then you have to talk about the Obama administration, the Democrats, essentially not pushing the door open, but just kicking the door off the hinges. You know, so there's been, the fact that there's been no prosecution for any for war crimes, the fact that the closest we've gotten, which is people like a Spanish judge, who a very high legal standing, who was basically browbeaten and beaten down by the U.S. State Department because you began to open investigations. I mean, these are crimes in themselves, blocking war crimes. You know, you want to talk about what's going to happen next. I mean, think about it. The biggest, most tangible federal jobs program, really the only one that the Obama administration has promulgated, has essentially been flooding the better part of $1 trillion a year into the military-industrial complex. You had a Hillary Clinton is the one. Remember her? She just quarterbacked a couple of years ago the $60 billion arms deal to Saudi Arabia. That's how much she cares about democracy. And now you have John Kerry running over to Egypt, where essentially, for all intents and purpose, we have our puppet, military dictator puppet Mubarak back. And now he's cranking out there. He's going to vomit some more Apache attack helicopters in there. So essentially, you know, we have minority rule here. And you know, there's this whole stuff about going back and demonizing you know, it's about Rumsfeld and Cheney is about as astute as going out to the sewer, the manhole cover, and lifting it up and saying, "My God, there's sewage down there." I mean, it's obvious. It's not helpful. We've had 6 years of the quote unquote other political party in power, and all we've had is more silent signing statements, more justifications for transgressions of international law, more subterfuge, more money going to repressive dictatorship, more money pumped into the military-industrial complex. So I think we need to get off of the obvious here. You know, as far as worry about our own party, I think we're going to have to either the Democratic Party, we're either going to have to take it back or we're going to have to break its back. I think all this pie-in-the-sky crap about, you know, how are you ever going to redress violations of international law if the people that are in power are protecting themselves? Because you can bet your booty that Miss Pelosi and Mrs. Hillary Clinton, you can bet your butt that they would be some of the first people to be indicted if there was ever a tribunal about the violations of international law that happened in the run-up to the Iraq War. So, you know, I don't know how helpful it is to continue.
Well, I think you're making
talk about how the last administration over 6 years ago acted. I think it's a little bit of a deflection.
Well, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to appreciate your point. I'm more on your side than Abe is, probably. Because
I can't argue with that.
Well, I believe that this is just simply an extension of a set of policies directed by the very, very powerful in a search for actually fossil fuels more than anything else. I believe that the notion of American imperialism is alive and not just well, but growing all the time. I think the United States is heading into an enormous critical disaster worldwide. And I think that this administration, for reasons that are very complicated and probably have a lot to do with intellectual limitations, are engaged in supporting an incredibly foolish step backward. And I think Dick Cheney is a total opportunist who is both at the beck and call of and is absolutely part of the Halliburton, oil, blah, 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 bunch of people that are pretty much dominating American foreign policy and a domestic policy to a great extent.
Yeah, I really can't argue with that.
So we can end it.
Yeah, okay, sure.
That's the end of it. Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about dogs. I have a dog theory.
Under the Bush regime, we saw executive power expand in scope beyond anything we had hitherto seen in this country, certainly beyond the strictures laid out in the Constitution.
You know, in the 1950s, there was a book called The Imperial Presidency. Now, my memory is bad. I can't remember who wrote it. Someone very respectable. And I remember being discussed in high school. And, you know, and that was a reaction to Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Well, sure.
It was a right-wing screed. But I really believe that, in fact, the issue is not with the public political world. I think that the issue really is with the moneyed class and with the direction
absolutely.
They're going.
Yeah, absolutely. At the highest levels in this country, and I dare say around the world, there is no distinction between economic and political power. They are, for all intents and purposes, one and the same. The mechanisms of our republic have been bought and paid for by the very wealthiest among us, and they are able to bring about, through their lackeys in government, things like the invasion of Iraq. And so when executive power expanded under the Bush regime in this country, the big worry was that even when Bush's term in office came to an end, even when he was no longer sitting in the White House, we would be faced with a new president of whatever political party who would be very reluctant to relinquish the newfound powers now commanded by the executive branch. And with Obama's administration, we see just that. Not only did he fail to get rid of the new surveillance state that was established under President Bush, he has expanded it beyond anything we had seen before.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm emphasizing this dramatic turn of events that happened under the 8 years of the Bush presidency. This is when America really got off track. Now, you're saying the signs were all there, and I'm not disputing that. But I'm saying to you, but for a few key selections of personnel and a few key decisions made by those personnel, the world might be vastly different than it is today.
Well,
you're saying that's an exercise in futility. Well, so be it.
Well, I don't know about exercise in futility. Here's the futility. Here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have fought a sequence of wars, some of them big, some of them little. Korea is the start of that process. Vietnam, you know, and so on. And in each and every case, it is the same game with the same sets of lies.
Yeah.
You know, differing somewhat, but it's basically the same. And this goes on and on and on. And we as a people are left in the dark and forced through patriotism into the bizarre position of supporting foolish wars. And I don't see anything changing. I don't think anything's different. I think it's just the same old stuff. New players, particularly in the opposition. But it's the game of people who profit from war.
It's the great game.
Well, yeah.
That they used to talk about.
They used to talk about
that.
That was during the old British Empire.
Right.
That's when they had India and Pakistan.
Before it became gauche to talk about the great game.
Yes.
And overt.
Gauche?
Gauche.
You're using gauche?
I am. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, noted intellectual and author Noam Chomsky speaks on state of insecurity. At 10 here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a human rights worker who is hunkered down in Baghdad talks about what life is like in Iraq now, very apropos of today's discussion.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to hear
that. Yes, and a look back at the failed U.S. policy that brought about the current situation in Iraq with peace activist Kathy Kelly. And at 11,
Kathy Kelly's very good.
She is. At 11 on stage and studio host D.M.A. Roberts looks at Shakespeare in the Park by the Portland Actors Ensemble.
And Shakespeare in the Park is very good.
Indeed it
is. See, there's good things happening. Don't be too depressed.
Yeah, Shakespeare, he wrote some good stuff.
About imperialism.
The Portland Actors Ensemble with director Elizabeth Huffman and actors Andrea White and Matt DiBiasio in Antony and Cleopatra. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Ruth Gunther, chief curator at the Portland Art Museum, about the art of the Louvre's Tuileries garden.
Tuileries. Give us that again, because I really like your French.
The art of the Louvre's Tuileries garden. That's what it says here on this piece of paper.
Les arts de Louvre.
The Louvre.
Oh, Tuileries.
Tuileries.
Okay, anyway.
All this and more coming up today on your listener-supported radio station. Yes. Let's go back to the phones.
Yeah, let's go back to the phones.
Joe, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hey, what's up?
I had just a little shift of gears, but and then I'm preaching to the choir here, but I'm just thinking that say again?
I'm actually having trouble with my microphone. Joe, repeat what you said, and let's see how it goes. Joe?
Are you there? Joe?
Can you hear me now? Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say, shifting gears. This is all enabled. It's only possible, and this is preaching to the choir because it makes me so furious. The media will frame and will give this narrative. You know, there's a background of every question. There's a framework. And I know this isn't maybe the way this is the case in all empires in the past. You know, but it's so egregious because I think the truth is is something you can seek out. You can look for people that don't have motivation. You know, you can look for sources without, you know, motivation, like, you know, a general or the U.S. Army. You know, the New York Times is always citing, you know, generals as, you know, a source when, you know, it's clear, a clear, you know, conflict of interest. Anyway, that was my comment. It's just, you know, it's a major cog in the wheel of this system of deception. And because I think the U.S. people, though they're deluded, and they are, I think people generally are more sane, obviously, than, you know, than sometimes people give them credit for. Anyway, I'll take my comment off the air.
I think it's really an interesting question. How long will American families suffer the loss of loved ones in pointless wars? How long will there not be an effort, a massive movement in opposition to these wars? How long will there be no massive, effective millions in the streets demands that we face global warming? The distractions presented at this time in history are many, and they're very effective. And this is not an unusual thing. It's not a new thing. It's just the way it is. And I think that we rail against it. I rail against it. Abe rails against it. But we, and at least I, and I think Abe too, understand that this is a game where the fix is in.
It is.
So
the problem is that
so let's watch Game of Thrones and relax, dude. See whose head gets chopped off. Whose sex life is enriched. Come on, let's get on.
The problem is I find myself constitutionally incapable of accepting that.
Oh.
Yeah, I can say on the one hand, and I can rationally accept that, yes, the fix is in, but that's not a world that I want to live in, nor do I choose to continue living in it. And that's why one of the reasons I do this program every week.
Well, you're not
in addition to the huge paycheck.
Yeah, yeah. You're not going to kill yourself, though.
No, I'm not going to do that. Okay. But I will watch Game of Thrones. Yeah. Who's next, Steve? Garrett, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
There was a guy who asked, you actually asked him earlier, what point were the people ever in charge?
Yeah.
And it actually brought something up for me that I had to call in about. Everyone's talking about these documents signed by white slave owners. No one actually is willing to go beyond Western European colonization history. The time in which the people were in charge was before white people landed here. That's when America really started to go downhill. And everyone wants to shut that out and go, well, that's irrelevant. It already happened. It's in the past. Let's move on. But if you actually look at the function, I mean, there were millions and millions of people here.
Mm-hmm.
They lived well. They lived free. And they all had a say in what happened in their societies. It really, really worked. I think the real problem, and no one's willing to confront it, is our problem in this nation is authority, it's in hierarchy, and it's in the fact that we don't have any power, and the people who have the power to do things like, I don't know, try people for war crimes, they get those positions of power so that they can sit on their hands. And we allow this because we are codependent, and us codependent people are dependent upon our narcissistic masters to tell us how things are. And it's the problem isn't in documents. It isn't in who's in charge. It's the fact that someone is in charge.
Well, and I think you're raising some very profound and interesting points. You know, for years we were taught that Native American cultures were primitive, that they were this, they were that. Well, they weren't industrial and they weren't highly mechanical in the way Europe was.
They were sophisticated.
But they were extremely sophisticated. They had very complex religious and social values and so on.
And they killed the world.
Yeah, and they did thrive. But also they too, in history that we know, made war and vicious war against lesser peoples in Mexico, in various parts of Latin America. So, in really what we're really talking about, we like to blame a modern industrial state for this, but what we're really talking about, I'm afraid, is a pattern of imperial behaviors that we see in all humans, regardless of their culture.
Primate dominance dynamics.
The idea of authority infects our conversation, and it infects the way that we try and go about change, because we even see it in the language. What do? We demand our rights. But a demand is nothing more than a very, very powerful request. It's not a claim. If you want your rights, you don't ask for them, and you don't scream for them, you declare them, and when a guy says you don't have them, you punch him in the face.
Ooh! Okay.
That's the only way you actually get your rights. It's the only way you get to stop this kind of thing from going on.
Well, that,
you
that,
want to end a war, you physically stop it with your hands.
Well, that has some truth to it, but the logic of that leads inevitably to weird single gunmen shooting teenagers. I mean, you understand what I'm saying.
Or it leads to popular revolution.
Or it leads to popular revolution.
I hate that those people are the only people that are actually willing to stand up for themselves. If everyday people were willing to say, no, I actually have this right and you're wrong. You know, not just to demand their rights or ask for them, but to say, no, I actually have these rights.
Well, I think,
they wouldn't be the only ones out there doing it.
Well, I think you're right. But here's the thing. Most people in this society have been delivered adequate, not great necessarily, not the best that's possible, but adequate goods, services, and so on, and they are pacified. The needs that they have are ameliorated through the system. If the system can deliver that, and as long as the system can deliver that, it's unlikely that a philosophical argument, an intellectual argument about freedom, is going to have any sway. The decision to do away with the draft, which all of us on the left back in the Vietnam era supported, was a very foolish thing to support. No. In fact, I think there should be universal military service and universal service to the community as an alternative. And then...
Like Heinlein?
Well, now I'm glad you raised Heinlein because he's the ultimate imperialist, isn't he? You know, this is Robert Heinlein, folks, who was a science fiction writer who was real fascist.
I like the idea of the service. I actually wish that the service also trained doctors and
could
join the service.
But that's, of course, all of that.
That everyone wants when they're in their late teens and early 20s, except that adventure could be delivering medicine instead of bullets.
Well, right. I think the point that Joe is trying to make is that if we brought back compulsory military service, and that if kids from all social and economic
service
classes
to the community,
sure, if kids from all social and economic classes knew that they were going to be put in uniform, we would probably not have these adventurous wars of choice and wars for profit that we find ourselves
on the other hand. That may not be true because look, we had Korea,
Vietnam,
we had Vietnam. I don't know that it's a way there. I don't think there's a magic key to changing things. I think what really needs to happen is an increased degree of awareness and sense of responsibility and moral and ethical rejuvenation of a nation that has lived lives throughout its history.
Hey,
there is a key. I think the key is to make sure that no one trains children to be codependent.
Well, that's an interesting point, and I want to thank you for the call.
Hey, thanks very much.
Thank you.
A sense of responsibility.
What?
A national sense of responsibility?
Yeah.
You just talked about... We don't even accept universally that climate change is actually happening in this country.
Well, it's not.
Stop.
Look, it's raining already.
Let's go to the phones. Harry, save us, Harry, please.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, a couple years ago, George Bush II wrote a book, and he...
He didn't write a book. Somebody wrote a book for him. Come on.
And in it, he mentions that he okayed the torture and the waterboarding of that one Al-Qaeda prisoner in Guantanamo Bay.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just wondering, how come no one's taken this book, given it to The Hague, and said, he's admitting it, how come we can't prosecute him as a war criminal? George Bush.
It's interesting that you ask that. I have right in front of me an article from The Guardian of London, late by Glenn Greenwald, late 2012. There were two cases under investigation relating to the U.S. torture program. There was one about the death of an Afghan detainee at a secret CIA prison in Afghanistan, and the other about the death of an Iraqi citizen while in CIA custody at the Abu Ghraib prison camp in Iraq. Those were the only two torture investigations that were opened. They were quietly closed by Obama's Justice Department in 2012, thus immunizing anybody from the Bush regime forever being charged with war crimes.
But they could still send them to The Hague, though. The Hague should see this information.
Well, there's look, there are ways to build more justice into the system.
There are ways to make America a more righteous nation. There are ways to build social democracy in America. But the likelihood of those happening, given the circumstances under which we live and the distractions which are provided to us, which, by the way, is what the current resurgence of fundamentalist, of nasty fundamentalism, Sunni fundamentalism in Iraq and the Levant, is all about. It's a wonderful distraction. And we will, I predict right now, right here, that we will be enmeshed in a war in that region within the next 5 years, probably less.
Okay. One last thing.
Okay.
A possible show topic in the for the future.
Sure.
A 9/11 truth movement.
Oh, you want to do that?
Yeah.
People want to do that.
We've done it.
We've done it. We've been there. I think there's a lot to be talked about and a little bit more known about it, but from my point of view, it becomes virtually irrelevant, and the idea of a complex plot to blow the buildings up and all that's unnecessary.
Come on, two planes, three buildings. Come on.
I'm not making any promises.
The world's laughing at us.
I'm not making any promises. We may or may not go there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
I don't know. I'm depressed.
Nobody from...
you're not allowed to be depressed on the radio. You're supposed to be up.
Nobody from the Bush administration will ever be brought to justice for the war crimes perpetrated in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's not going to happen for this very simple reason. If we handed over any of those people to any sort of international tribunal, that would be a concession that there exists a body in the world that can exercise sovereignty over presidents and ex-presidents of the United States, and we will never allow that to happen.
Well, and I think one of the things that we really have not even begun to broach is, why was Obama such a disappointment? Why is he so weak?
And we have broached that. We've talked about that.
Well, I really think it has to do with child rearing.
I'm just going to let that sail okay. right on by. Let's All go right. back to the phones. Harvey, good morning.
Hi. I'd like to thank President Obama for putting solar panels on the White House, because I'd like to talk about the true cost of a gallon of gas. You know, we have a billion cars doing two rush hours a day, all the trucks, all the buses. This mm-hmm. is worldwide, all the planes in the sky, all the boats in the ocean, all the construction machinery, the farming machinery, the armed forces use.
The power
the
plants.
Utilities. It yeah. goes, the recreational vehicles. It's all carbon pumping into the atmosphere. And I believe we're at a turning point here. We can't afford that anymore with global warming causing all these disasters. Insurance companies are starting to balk at all this. And the true cost of a gallon of gas, I believe that when we went to war, that cost trillion at least. Mm-hmm. Some say up to $4 trillion. And so it's not $4 that you're paying out of your pocket. You can add another $4 at least from paying through your tax dollars. I call it the war tax.
Yes.
Right now, where our armed forces are escorting tankers through the Gulf or through the Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz there.
Yeah.
This is all paying. We've built an infrastructure that makes gasoline cheap. That's what we've done, and it's time to move away from that toward solar. Some of the benefits are doesn't use any water. Coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear are second only to agriculture in their daily uses of planet, of water, of our freshwater resources. And it has no moving parts to wear down, no CO2 emissions. They don't come with sirens and evacuation plants like nuclear power plants. And it will reduce our cost of war if we don't have to go offshore for resources, for energy resources. So it's a plus-plus all the way around. I think it's time to get star-powered. Let's get solar.
Okay, thanks for the call.
I agree.
And that's it may happen someday, but not soon.
Yeah, a big accident at a nuclear power plant is a huge public health and environmental disaster. An accident at a solar plant is a nice day.
right. No, but it's really interesting. You know, I mean, the disaster in Japan, nuclear disaster. Uh-huh. People are just inured. They tolerate it. Now our fish has gotten radiation in it. It's very depressing.
Whatever.
People are willing to. Well, people are willing to tolerate enormous degradations as long as the Game of Thrones on TV.
Yeah, bread and circuses, man.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, World Cup Thursday morning, USA Germany. Just saying. One more phone call. Who do we have? Oh, no more phone calls.
Oh,
you know, usually we manage to end our shows on sort of an up note, but I'm not seeing it today. Save us, Joe. Say something positive. Now, do it. Do it.
Yeah, sure. No. Bye.
All right. Thank you all for your phone calls today, for participating in this conversation. You all do give me hope, as hopeless as I may sound sometimes. I do appreciate it. Thank you.
From those nights, Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Jackson County, Oregon recently faced off with some of the most powerful corporations in the world when local farmers led an effort to ban the growth of GMO crops. But a recently passed state law, first written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, means that, for now, no other municipality in Oregon may do so. Where did the ALEC bill come from, and how was it passed? We take a closer look at ALEC in Oregon with a special report by KBOO's investigative news team on Jackson and Josephine County's GMO bans on Tuesday, June 24th at 5:45, right after the evening news.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 8:59. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, on alternative radio, noted intellectual and author Noam Chomsky speaks on state of insecurity. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a human rights worker who is hunkered down in Baghdad talks about what life is like in Iraq now. And a look back at the failed U.S. policy that brought about the current situation in Iraq with peace activist Kathy Kelly. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Dimay Roberts looks at Shakespeare in the Park by the Portland Actors Ensemble with director Elizabeth Huffman and actors Andrea White and Matt DiBiasio, Anthony and Cleopatra. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Bruce Gunther, chief curator at the Portland Art Museum, about the art of the Louvre's Tuileries Garden. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Security of the population is just not much of a concern. Security of state power is a concern. The security of crucial domestic interest is a concern. The United States, similar societies, that happens to be the corporate sector, but not the population. What's the reason? I mean, a lot of it just has to do with the mechanics of getting to a position of